I want to ask you to do something rather un-Presbyterian at this point. I want you to take a pew Bible out of the pew rack and turn to the book of Isaiah, to chapter 35. Now, if all the pew Bibles we had in the nave were of the same edition, I could give you the page number, but alas, they aren't. So you're going to have to find Isaiah on your own. Lest I assume too much, Isaiah follows the Psalms, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament. For two Advent Sundays, Isaiah 35. For two Advent Sundays, we are considering Isaiah's prophetic visions of the restoration of Judah after the people's long exile. These visions offered words of hope and promise amidst difficult, even desperate situations. Words of encouragement to a people who were having difficulty finding their courage. Across the centuries, Isaiah's words have also been understood by Christian theologians and people as descriptions of the new age that was begun with the birth of Jesus Christ and of the final redemption of earth at his return, signaling a future for those weighed down by hopelessness and sorrow. This passage from Isaiah 35 seems at first glance to provide yet another variation on the restoration and peace that await the exiles. Whereas last week's reading from the 11th chapter foretold a day when lions and lambs would lie down together, the dominant image at the beginning of Isaiah 35 are of flora rather than fauna. The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom. Like the crocus, it shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. This vision describes the transformation of a land of leanness and non-productivity into a garden alive with colorful blossoms. The reference to the glory of Lebanon and the majesty of Carmel and Sharon add to the promise of reforestation. But Isaiah has more in mind than merely a change in the scenery. The restoration of the land hints broadly at the restoration of the people, who have been scattered abroad and are awaiting divine intervention to bring them home again. Strengthen the weak hands, Isaiah says, and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who are of a fearful heart, be strong, do not fear. Here is your God, the Lord will come to save. In the wonderful imagery of the third strophe of the vision, Isaiah blends the transformation of the lives of God's people with the transformation of the natural order. Then the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the speechless sing for joy. For waters shall break forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. God here is the life giver, the provider of joy, the grantor of beauty and splendor. The world will look different as God comes to save the people of God. The oppressed earth will receive attention equally with that extended to the oppressed of the earth. This prophetic poem then reaches its culmination and climax in the final strophe, which has proven to be something of a puzzle for translators over the years, and thus the reason to ask you to have that Bible in front of you. The Hebrew of verse 8 has been especially problematic. The NRSV in front of you says, a highway shall be there, and it shall be called the Holy Way. The unclean shall not travel upon it, but it shall be for God's people. Now, most translations, like the NRSV, follow a similar reading of the text. But look for a moment at the two footnotes at the bottom of the page, on the bottom of that column under verse 8, which suggests that the Hebrew is uncertain. Indeed, it may actually read as follows: a highway shall be there, and it shall be called the Holy Way. The unclean shall not pass it by, but it shall be for them. Now, the two readings are slightly different in wording, but worlds apart in meaning. Either God's way will exclude the unclean, or it is intended for them as well. In a compelling article some years ago, the Hebrew scholar Walter Harrelson made a strong case for the latter reading, for the reading of the footnotes. And my rather unscientific poll of several Hebrew scholars in recent years seems to confirm Harrelson's take on the matter. Harrelson argued that Isaiah intended to promise God's tender care for those who might normally be excluded from redemption. This holy way will be one that the unclean, that is, those normally kept at the margins of the community, will not find close to them at all. Now, why, if that is the case, have translators so regularly missed such an understanding of the text? Well, in part because the text is corrupted and it's hard to tell from the original documents. And it's not surprising, says Harrelson, because the more common translation fits within the theology of Israel. But there's no indication that the transformation of nature and history of which Isaiah speaks has only the Hebrew people in mind, or only those who are faithful to Torah. In fact, the text places its emphasis upon God's gathering up all those who are wounded of body, all those with physical limitations, all those marked as unclean, and those with limited rational abilities. Even fools, it says, shall not go astray. Just as the waste places of the earth will undergo transformation, so will those who do not enjoy robust health or strength or capacity to cope with life. The highway is laid down for everyone. There is no limitation of access to this highway. It is laid down for all. And if that is true, then this is a very different kind of highway that Isaiah envisions. If I were to use metaphors from our own time to describe it, I would say this holy way is the highway of the great unwashed. I see a highway that starts not at the airport, but at the local bus station, and the hotels and the stores and the restaurants along the roadside are Motel 6 and the Dollar General store and Waffle House, rather than Ritz-Carlton and Tiffany's and Le Bernardin. This is the welcoming road of all God's children, particularly those who have not been invited on the journey before. Isaiah presents here a daring vision of hope on the other side of loss and illness and suffering. The old saying is that we make plans according to our ideas, but we obey our pain. If we read Isaiah's words with this newer interpretation, what we discover is that there is hope on the other side of that pain. And that is a word I claim for all who are hurting this day, hurting in body or mind or spirit. It's a word I claim for all who find themselves on the outside looking in. It's a word I claim for those who fight against the demons of mental illness or addiction, those who languish in veterans' hospitals all alone in this season, for the homeless men and women who stand like ragtag sentries with their pleading signs on our street corners and our subway stairs, and all the other untouchables in our culture. It's a word I claim for all those who have suffered great sadness and loss in this year now past, and face the coming of Christmas with as much dread as joy, and perhaps more. There's a poignant scene in the musical Cotton Patch Gospel, which speaks to such a promise. In the second act, as the drama of Jesus' entry into Jerusalem is unfolding, the story's narrator seems to borrow a bit from Isaiah's vision as interpreted by Jesus. The scene unfolds at the beginning of what we call Holy Week, though in Cotton Patch Gospel it is voiced in the southern drawl and vernacular. In this retelling of Jesus' visit to the temple and his encounter with the money changers, the narrator speaks of Jesus taking a sledgehammer, walking into the courtyard of First Church in Atlanta, by the way, and calling the leaders there sons of snakes. He's beginning to shout at them, "My house shall be known for its commitment to God, but you have turned it into a banker's club and a religious racket." And then, very quietly, the narrator says, "Then the blind people and the broken people and the young people started gathering with him into the church, and he was making the needy of them well. He was saying to them, 'Come to me, everybody that's had a belly full of emptiness. Get in the harness with me, for my harness is practical and my assignment is joy.'" Those words, like the words Jesus first spoke, were echoes of Isaiah's vision of life under the reign of God. This vision was and is an affirmation of God's future, of a time when God's reign will transform life on earth. Despite all those who would claim that people's lives are expendable, that the poor don't count, and that the days belong to the strong and not to the weak, that the ones with the most money or power or prestige always win the day, the prophet Isaiah sees the very different future that God has in store and knows that God is trustworthy, even when our mortal leaders are not. "This is how life under God's reign will be," says Isaiah. Of course, if that's true, then we may hear these words as judgment upon those of us in the community of faith to whom they are addressed. For obviously, Isaiah believes that the community is living in contradiction to what God intends and is bringing to pass. If God's intention is that the holy way be an open way that invites and includes everyone, then we have work to do to measure up to that intention here and now. But don't hear Isaiah's words only as indictment, for inherent in his vision is a gracious invitation. These promises of Isaiah and their counterparts in the Gospels have a capacity to draw God's community into the world they sketch. Even as judgment falls on the community for being so out of step with God's intention, the community finds itself drawn to act and to live its life out of that promised future of God. This vision of the end of our exile not only influences us as God's people, it shapes and forms us. It gives us power and impetus, and it draws us forward into God's promised future. Advent is a time for us to reflect on the coming of God in holy mystery, the coming of God into the midst of life's frailties and imperfections, the coming of God into a world that is itself unclean and lean and unproductive, so as to transform that world into productivity and beauty and grace. Advent is a time for remembering the coming of God to set the human community on its way to wholeness and blessedness, on its way to the healing center of all existence. We're not there yet. We're not there yet. But by God's grace, we are on the way. It's called the Holy Way. From wilderness to Zion lay a road that shall be the Lord's highway. On it will walk the weak and the strong, and all who by grace to God belong. It's grace for all. For all will open swing the gracious highway of the King.